Good evening and welcome to Town Square. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. As always, our conversations include you, and if you'd like to join us, the phone lines are open. Our number is 941-3689. If you call us from Oahu, that's the number to call. And if you're calling us from anywhere else on the neighbor islands, it's a toll-free call at 877-941-3689. Well, the legislature is only a week into its task of defining how public funds will be spent. But throughout the year, though, family foundations decide what they'll support and who will get their money. Economic easing in many organizations may have loosened the firm hold on grant applications, but are organizations staffed by a younger demographic looking for something different from what their older counterparts seek to fund? A significant amount of recent research suggests they do, and tonight we'll look at millennial donors and values in grant making. We're joined by a panel of women who know those values pretty well. Melissa Jackson is on the board of the Zilber Family Foundation and a member of the governing board at Castle Medical Center, where she's helped to establish a best-in-class birthing center. She's also a founder and steering committee member of the Hawaii Chapter of Emerging Practitioners in Philanthropy. That's a national network of foundation professionals and social entrepreneurs committed to social justice. Also here is Ann Swain Kerr. She is the co-chair of the Keith and Judy Swain Family Foundation. The foundation funds in the areas where family members live in Orange County, California, and the state of Hawaii. Their grant applicants are by invitation only, and their focus is on women, children, and youth in underserved communities. She's also on the board of the Hawaii Chapter of Emerging Practitioners in Philanthropy. And to round out our board here, in at least CR7 for the moment, we have Lisa Maruyama. She's making a return visit to the program, the executive director of Hawaii Alliance of Nonprofits, otherwise known as HANO, and she works with many of the organizations looking to make or grant to others. Welcome to all of you. It's good to have you here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy to be here.
When you hear this business that somehow millennials are different, now you guys can we fess up and say that you guys are Gen Xers?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Now that we've established all of that, that we've got a Gen X movement going on here, but looking at how you give versus how some millennials, some of the people that you work with now give and look at giving, is there really something to this? Do you buy into the idea that somehow different generations look at grant making and how they make donations and whether they're going to be involved with any form of philanthropy differently from other generations, Mel?
I think it is different. I think what it used to be is just you write a check for a certain amount and you send it in and you don't have a lot to do with it and you're asked every year to do the same thing. And I think now what's happening is people want to have personal interest in it. They want to see it through. They want to volunteer with that program that they might be donating to. They want to be part of it.
Anne?
Yeah, absolutely. I actually wanted to share a little information about a study that was done from 2164, a consulting firm that deals with next gen issues, specifically in family foundations and the Center for Johnson Center for Philanthropy. They came out with research just recently that they interviewed something like 300 high net worth millennials and Gen X folks. And they did online surveys. And what they saw was this parallel between all of them. And they kind of compiled all the information into little areas. One is the next gen folks, millennials and Gen X, are driven by values and not valuables. So they are inclined to really want to carry on the legacy that was established by their grandparents or parents, but they're not really driven by the notoriety. For example, they don't want a name on a building. You know, it's a very different approach to philanthropy. And then impact first, you know, how can they really have impact, really questioning that? Like, okay, we've been doing it like this, but what can we do to actually transform the philanthropy that we're already doing?
And how do you measure that in ways that can tell you whether or not you're making an impact?
Yeah, so really, really questioning, I think, the traditional role that philanthropy has played. And then time, talent, treasure, and ties. So that means hands-on engagement, like Mel was saying, for example. I think she's a perfect example of a next-gen philanthropist, just in the way she lives her life. Close relationships, offering personal and professional talent. Oftentimes, there's this pattern of people growing up volunteering. Mel and I think that's something that we really connected with when we met each other. And it's a core value within our family system. So we were probably forced to volunteer at a very young age, whether we wanted to or not, but it was embedded in us. Those values were embedded, and being philanthropic. And then believing in collaboration, like, what does that mean? Like, working together, not sort of this, okay, we're going to do it this way.
Right. Let's start to take some of those things apart, because a lot of those things, as I've gone quickly by, as people have been listening, and let's talk about them a little bit more fully, because part of it is how you learn when you're growing up. You may not do it right away, but part of what came out of that Next Gen study, too, is the fact that this is something that came from home. I mean, it didn't just sit on top of them and say, oh, by the way, you should be doing some philanthropy. But this began at home. Once upon a time, that was a family value, no matter how much money you had. There was this idea that people gave, that charitable giving was part of living. And then it kind of went away and came back to the, well, it's just going to be, if you can, you'll do it with a check. And now we see the pendulum swing to where you've got, in particular, millennials and next gens who say, we want all in. Yeah. And all in means much more than just even, you know, writing a check or looking for the impact or all that, but he wants the whole package, which can be really tough for you guys. How do you make that kind of thing start to happen generationally differently now than perhaps what we've seen happen over the last 20 years? Because, I mean, you're both moms.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you ask for help. See, it's the collaborating with other people, with other foundations to make things actually happen. One of the things you said was what reminded me of just being on the ground, making a difference in volunteering, being part of something. You don't have to give money for that. You can choose to be part of it. You can choose here in Hawaii to be part of it by driving home from Costco and stopping at a beach park and dropping off diapers. You can do that with your kids and teach it very young, and that's a simple thing you can do. But really, it's bringing people together. My philosophy really is relationships with people. And I think that's how you make a difference.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely agree with that. I think it's a value system that is kind of implemented early on in childhood. So I feel fortunate that within my family, my parents kind of practiced what they preached, and so they were really involved, and I saw that. And I might not have seen, like, really understood what they were trying to say, but it stuck with me, and as I became an adult, it made sense to really give back to the community, and it just felt right, and I think Mel's probably similar in that way. So I think modeling it, more than just talking about it, but modeling it. So, and, you know, I think philanthropy, too, is the word itself is really giving of your time and or money. So I think people look at philanthropy as you have to have a lot of money in order to be philanthropic. And I think there are plenty of examples of people who are philanthropic because they donate so much of their time and energy into making the community around them better.
Do you remember the very first time that you thought to yourself, I'm doing this on my own, I'm giving on my own, I'm not doing it because somebody else told me to or because it's a family value, but just because I want to?
Yeah. Of money or of time?
Of anything, where you just thought to yourself, oh, I'm doing what I really want to do because I want to do it.
Yeah, absolutely.
As an independent act.
Yeah, it feels really good. There's nothing, I think, more fulfilling than helping other people.
Do you actually remember when you had that thought, how old you were or any of the circumstances?
Well, when I was thinking about a career and what I wanted to do, it often was I want to teach or I want to go into the Peace Corps or do something like that. So I think for me, making the decision to actually go into the Peace Corps was the first step of doing something where people my peers thought I was a little crazy. Like, why would you want to do this? And for me, it felt really natural. I didn't look at it as a sacrifice in that way. I just looked at it as this is going to be an experience that's going to shape my life. So, yeah, that's probably my first experience.
Mel, do you remember?
My first. I actually think it was, gosh, I think I may have been at a Boys and Girls Club in Milwaukee, and I was watching my grandfather, and I watched what his face looked like. And it was a feeling I got, and then watched kind of what had unfolded at the event, and I think that was the first time I really saw what you can do.
If you're just joining us tonight, we're talking about philanthropy, yes, but really looking at what happens in different generations, specifically Gen Xers and millennials and some of the younger folks who on occasion have been sort of levied with this idea that they don't give back and they don't do as much. And then on the flip side of it, seeing some very real differences in how they do that, that just stands that other idea right on its head. If you are a Generation Xer, if you are a Gen Yer, if you are a millennial, anyway, in other words, anybody other than a baby boomer where some of this stuff seems to be expected, we especially want to hear from you. We're not saying baby boomers can't call, but we really want to hear from those of you who are a little bit younger and just to see how this syncs up with how you look at life and how you look at the idea of giving, or if you are involved in a family foundation quietly and nobody else really knows about it. I want to hear some of those stories, too. 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. So looking at how this happens first as a smaller person, but then you grow up and then suddenly you have this idea. You got the feeling, Mel, when you saw your grandfather's face and the impact that what he was doing was having on this crowd of people. You had the thought, and I'm going to go off and go to Peace Corps, and people are looking at you like, why? And then you begin to mature a little bit more and create lives where this is very much a part of everything that you are. I want to turn to you a little bit now and talk to you, Lisa, because you've heard the girls' stories and you're involved with them, but how representative is this kind of thing in other family foundations, folks that you deal with, and in how the view of how we're going to make grants has changed?
Yeah, I think it's a welcomed perspective in our community. And I think, I first met Anne a couple years ago, and she just has this delightful way of sharing these wonderful values around philanthropic partnerships with nonprofits that was just so refreshing, just because I think nonprofits really welcome the chance to be able to feel safe about providing feedback about what might have worked or what didn't work around some kind of a grant, And at the end of the day, really, it's about going in together, right, to the community to make improvements, to move the needle on bettering the community. And so if the relationship is very positive and constructive between the funder and the fundee, then I think it results in co-learning around what can be made better, around how the delivery of the money or the resources can go via a nonprofit into the community to make impact. So if you can make that relationship constructive and productive, all it really just means a better delivery of service and impact for the people that benefit from it, which is all of us, really, at the end of the day. So we really appreciated that these voices and these messages were sort of rolling out via the organization EPIP that both Anne and Melissa help run. We actually love the additional kind of values that we're starting to see funders in our local community embrace, which is this notion of comfort around multi-year funding, as opposed to just these one-off, one-time, one-year kind of grants, that while they're very welcomed, one-year grants are very welcomed by nonprofits, it's very hard to make an impact in a year.
And hard to measure that.
And hard to measure that. And just when the nonprofit has gotten going to find the stride in the delivery, it's done. And so there's not a lot of insight that can be perceived and retrieved from that kind of short relationship.
Right. And so there's a lot of money scramble that has to go on and happen.
Absolutely. And then, you know,
year.
While you're delivering the service, you're still pondering how are you going to continue to keep your staff on board after this funding has gone away? And how do you continue that and keep the momentum going and continue to have impact? So that's one area that I think we appreciate that the funding community is coming around to. And then also this notion that it doesn't always have to be project specific. It can be for operational support to the organization to help build the organization's capacity so that you know, I've been in the nonprofit sector for a long time, and back in the day it was, we will not fund staff.
That was a no-no. Well, it was like the ultimate no-no, the first question.
Right.
This is not going for staff, right?
Right. Yeah. But, you know, we all wish we could have little menehunes that come into the organization at night and kind of do the work, but we're doing the work, and the work doesn't get done without staff, and the work doesn't get done without overhead and computers and all of those kinds of things that enable us to do our jobs better. And so we really like the idea that funders are coming around to the notion that they can make an impact in providing some capacity to the organization in order for it to do its mission, and recognizing that nonprofits are partners and that they sometimes have the expertise to be able to deliver on that mission, and that there should be a trusting relationship. The goal should be to have a trusting relationship with the nonprofit organization. And then, you know, what we've been hearing a little bit lately from funders in our community is they're open to feedback. So what worked, what didn't, and what could we do differently in our funding or our time that we're giving or the expertise that we're providing? What can we do differently to improve this this relationship? There is a funding entity here in Hawaii that actually does learning circles where they sit around and they actually share plus delta type, you know, how, what could we do to improve this going forward? Because ultimately the goal is to improve the community. So we're finding that really refreshing, and these voices are growing. And so we encourage it, and we love that Hano actually provided a convening last fall at our conference for EPIP to have a panel. And the feedback that we got from nonprofit participants was it was just so nice to sit in the room with our funding partners and talk story and to hear that it's okay to tell us if we've made a mistake or it's, you know, there's not any kind of punitive relationship to
right. I mean, and many of those things that were once upon a time and not that long ago. I mean, if you go back 15 years or even 10 years ago, the idea of this great collaboration, people would talk a good game about that, but you weren't really seeing it in practice. Everybody had their own little fiefdom and wanted to hunker down and in some cases make sure they got the credit for it. And then there was also this idea of, well, don't talk about the bad stuff. You know, I mean, you've got to put a good face out to the community and all of that. Now, yeah, it's a good thing to put your best foot forward, but there's also a lot to be gained when you can be honest and real and sit down and talk about what's really, truly happening. When do you think that, you know, you saw that shift begin?
Oh, you know, I think change agents like Melissa and Anne, who are part of EPIP, who are really trying to not only share those values, but facilitate platforms in which others can come together to explore it together. And that, you know, that's where we are in the community, Bethann. We're around figuring out what we believe, I think. And so facilitators are needed to help change those conversations, you know. And don't get me wrong, I want to be very clear that we're not looking for ways for nonprofits to be not good stewards of money, because certainly when a lot of money is being shared in this community, we want to do our best and being most cost effective and with the money. And we want to be good stewards. So I'm not asking for, you know, I'm not being an apologist for those organizations that don't spend the money wisely. But I think as soon as you can open the dialogue between the funder and the fundee, it makes for good lessons learned together. You know,
well, especially this understanding that it may be a nonprofit, but it's still a business.
Right.
And there are certain practices that are best and good and highest best practices that
Absolutely.
We expect to be used.
Absolutely.
And not that it's just a bunch of airy-fairy
right.
do-gooders. And the ideas That's around how people get involved with philanthropy and what makes one organization really tip-top and another one, you know, marginal
right,
can boil down to some of those practices.
Absolutely.
And we got kind of hip to that not that long ago when we started to share some of the very mm-hmm. not so good things about what has gone on in mm-hmm. the community, and to do it without shame. That became, I think, the big thing, or we do not agree. Was the whole the shaming issue? Was the shaming issue a part of the fact that we got over ourselves and we're okay with talking about the things that didn't go so well in a project, or didn't, and not doing with, let's be not other apologists or just create explanations for it, but really looking at it sort of dispassionately and know that we could do better next time.
So being open about the things that you've learned that haven't been so great.
And being willing to share them without sort of yeah. trying to label, you know, someone as you are the problem, or there, you know, there was some amount of a project that didn't go well because of, and then you list all the things that, you know, you're laying blame and all of that. It just seems that there's been a real foundational change in how we regard each other in the business of nonprofits.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's also important for the other side, the funders, to be really transparent and also to not be hesitant to share their mistakes. And I think that creates a relationship that's trusting. And I don't know if that is a very comfortable thing to actually happen. So I think that's another trend I think that's happening right now, just sort of nationwide, of really pushing the transparency of philanthropists and being okay with making mistakes, being okay with taking risk, and really having those honest conversations with the nonprofits that you're working with.
If you're just joining us tonight, we're talking about philanthropy and, in part, what happens as generations give differently. Particularly tonight, we're talking about some of the research surrounding next gens and millennials. And if that's you, we want to hear from you. Are you, in fact, looking at how you give a little differently, perhaps, than your parents or certainly your grandparents? Are you giving at all? How much are you really involved in the business of philanthropy? 941-3689 is our number, or 877-941-3689. You guys are really quiet. I don't know whether you're just sitting back and listening to all this going, ooh, maybe I should be giving, or, ooh, but I do, and I don't really want to talk about it. I mean, we see both of those polar ideas happening with generations that we have labeled, you know, generation, you know, next, or Gen Y, or, I mean, you can put, and some of that stuff just doesn't mean a whole lot. Some social scientists suggesting that really it's a matter of what a generation feels politically with different things happening within its years of coming of age that make more of a difference than particular dates of time. So all of this we're taking with a grain of salt. But for those people who are in their 30s or certainly their late 20s, do you have a consciousness about giving and philanthropy? And if so, what is it? 941-3689, we want to know. Or 877-941-3689. Lisa, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just thinking about if we do want to expand, have a conversation about what the expanded definition of philanthropy is, then really volunteerism actually plays a large role in that. And Melissa did allude to the fact that millennials and, you know, I want to qualify, we're generalizing for the purpose of this conversation, but, you know, not everyone is the same, of course, in this generation, but they tend to be interested in really getting in deep with the organization through volunteerism.
Yeah, being all in.
Being all in, you know, they may be able to make financial gifts, but they also want to really, really meaningfully understand what that organization's doing on the ground. And so they'll often just be there to do, you know, a lot of the community work. So that's lovely. And I think what we have to do is expand our expectations, our notions about what volunteerism is, not just with young people, but with the older folks too, who are contemplating retirement but have so much expertise and so much history and context. And as they vacate the workforce, they're taking with them so much knowledge. And I worry that some of that is not being passed on. And is there a role for that, the baby boomers who are contemplating retirement, to come back and provide some kind of expertise to not just nonprofits, all types of organizations, and through volunteerism? So Yeah, I think we would be doing ourselves a service if we expanded our ideas about volunteerism. We became adaptable to different ways of volunteering, and we saw volunteering as philanthropy as well. We would be doing ourselves a good, you know, a favor. We'd be working cost effectively. And I think that resonates really well with funders as well, that we're being very resourceful about
What expertise and how we can get it.
And not growing irresponsibly and hiring and thinking about other ways in which we can capitalize on human resources, for sure.
But looking at the idea, as you suggest, of volunteerism as a form of philanthropy that we don't talk about a whole lot, though, it seems to have gotten a shot in the arm of late when you see commercials where it's inviting to people to come in and be part of, you know, volunteer days for this, and not just in ways that used to happen traditionally, but really making an effort for people to understand that this is a worthy expenditure of their time and how they fit into their communities by being volunteers with whatever time they have. Just that the push that we've seen in commercials and in people's conversations. I don't remember that, you know, that really was a big part of the general consciousness or, you know, the commercial consciousness 20 years ago.
Absolutely. And, you know, also on the flip side, nonprofit organizations need to ready themselves to be receptive to that workforce or to that cohort of volunteers. So it's not the just the envelope stuffing, you know, kind of the old school kind of notion of the envelope stuffing.
And not
stuffing.
Saying that's not important, because God knows that, public radio could not get along with our compliment people who come in here and stuff envelopes.
And maybe it was wrong of me to call it old school, because it does still happen for those who are doing, you know, end of the year, donor appeals. So, but in other ways that you can make space in your organization to accommodate that kind of resource. And so we have to start thinking out of the box about that. And not think about traditional staffing structures, you know.
A lot of things are changing, and we're talking about them tonight on Town Square. Want to hear from you, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Philanthropy among younger donors and grant makers, family foundations. How has that changed? What happens in our communities? If you're involved with one, we want to hear from you. If you are actively donating or thinking about that, maybe it's time for you to do that. We'd like to have that conversation too. 941-3689. Going to Paul, calling us from Maui. Aloha, Paul.
Yeah, hi, how are you?
I'm well. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I read a study a few years ago where this organization had studied generations and their likelihood to give, and they found that the generations under roughly age 35 now were the least likely to give money since they had been doing this study, but they were the most likely to volunteer in all of the years that they've looked at generations. So I inferred that the younger generation wants to see their money do good, and they also wanted to participate in in the good they were doing. So I thought that was just an interesting study, that they don't want to give money, but they wanted to give time, which I think is probably as valuable or more valuable than giving money. That's all I had.
Thanks very much, Paul. I mean, clearly, organizations need both. They need people who can come in and volunteer and do good things, and they also need to have the money side of it, too. But what we've just heard from Paul in some ways reflects some of the research that we've seen that shows that we're dealing with opposites within the same generational, you know, spread, that there isn't just this one way that millennials look at giving or the way that, you know, Generation X or Y may look at it, that it looks a little different depending upon where you are and what you do and what your experience is.
I think this is a really exciting time. In philanthropy, I think there are major shifts taking place.
And what would those shifts be that you see?
Well, I think the reason I fell in love with philanthropy was because of the shifts that were taking place. Initially when I stepped into my role with my family foundation, I was kind of hesitant because I thought, well, it's the have-nots. Is it reinforcing the system? And is it really something that I want to be a part of? But fortunately, I my family, they're not like that. So I felt like, okay. But then when I tapped into all these organizations, 2164, which I mentioned, Resource Generation, the National Center for Responsive Philanthropy, there's a handful of really exciting things happening and driven by young people, Gen X, millennials, people who are of wealth, people who aren't, and who are staff at foundations. And they're really emphasizing social change through philanthropy in a very different light. Some examples are, you know, creating advisory boards, including community members on your board, socially responsible investing, PRIs, MRIs, really having full impact, really incorporating philanthropy in a different way. What other things?
Well, you don't have to run through the whole
list. Well, they're all so exciting.
I know. There's bubbles. I'm watching you. It's really quite delightful to see.
I really look at it as a movement, and it's being driven by young people. And it's very, very exciting. And it's going to happen. There's, $4.1 trillion that's going to be transferred over to the next generation. And next generations, millennials and Gen X's, this transition is going to take place, and it's already taking place. And as people are taking on positions of leadership in their communities, we're going to start seeing a huge shift in philanthropy, and I think we're already seeing it.
Mel?
Very well said, Anne. She's absolutely right. I think it's new territory in some ways, because all of it you look at the studies, it's a huge shift from grandparents to parents, now sometimes skipping the parents and going right to the grandchildren, of how are they going to be responsible and how they're donating to the communities that they live in or wherever they decide to donate. And how best is the art of giving, really. How best do you do that? How best do you teach it? How best do you share that with other families learning how to donate? Gosh, Anne's been such a – I have to say this because she's been such a mentor for me, because she teaches me something new every day about philanthropy. And it's to work with the EPIP group has been amazing. Just all the different talents and all the different young people really coming together that are quietly. People quietly want to do things. I think that's a big difference from how maybe the grandparents or the older generation wanted to do it. They liked the big names. I think the young people kind of come in a little under the radar and just want to be able to do good in their communities.
In a way, that seems to be a little bit at odds with our greatly consumerist society, you know, where everybody's got to have
24/7 news
the
cycle,
brand. Yeah, but the, yeah, you know, the brand new phone and, you know, the latest iteration of the iPad or whatever tablet may be, or whatever cool thing may be out there for whatever reason, that seems to be very loudly ringing in the ears of young people as much as anybody else. I mean, people who have disposable income of any sort, but particularly when you look at ads and you see that real pitch to that, you know, 25 to, you know, 40-year-old, and what that means in buying stuff versus what that means with the money that may go into philanthropy. Are we painting with too broad a brush here, Mel, in terms of when we talk about young people want this or different generations want that? Does this get you rankled at all to have it sort of break down along those lines?
Someone a long time ago taught me you have three jars. It's one to keep, one to save, and one to give away. So one to spend, one to save, one to save and one to give away. It's you can consume all the things you want. That's people do that. Whether they have happiness, who knows? More people, I think, are learning to give. Again, it's the art of giving. And they're just looking how to do it, whether they're looking to do volunteer work, whether they're looking to write that check, whether they are going out and looking for something that they can better our society and their communities. People want to. They don't always know how to.
Or maybe they're not asked in the right way that makes sense for them, too.
And maybe, yeah, it's got to be something that touches them so that they get the feeling that, okay, I want to do this.
it used to be this idea that, you know, it's not what the organization needs, but it's what the donor needs. It's what fulfills their need to give. And if you can touch that, then you have a better chance of having them sync up with you and your organization. But trying to get to that and make that case seemed to be a little bit more difficult. Lisa, I'm going to let you go. Then we're going to take a couple more calls.
Yeah. No, I just wanted to very quickly say that I think social media has really transformed the way the message gets out, so that you can communicate the need. So you think about these crowdfunding things that are online where you can actually buy a goat in another country. You know, and we are deemed as Americans very insular, but I think social media and 24/7 news cycle has allowed us to be more informed about what is going on in not just our community, but in other communities and globally as well, so that we can be more socially conscious. And so I think you might see some of that instantaneous compassion and understanding maybe with this generation, this younger generation, because they're so technologically savvy. So maybe it's allowed them to be a little bit more socially conscious.
I want you just to think on this one for a second, because I want to take a few more calls. But the idea that it may be easier to do something halfway around the world than to do something in your own neighborhood, and how that plays out as you've seen what your own family foundations have done, and also as you've been talking to others, Anne and Mel, and we'll talk about that in just a moment. But if you'd like to join the conversation, the phone lines are open at 941-3689 if you're on Oahu. That's the number to call, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Waiting patiently from Kalihi, Scott is on the line. Thanks so much for your patience, and welcome to Town Square.
Aloha. Beth Ann, what a sensational show this is. I got in late, so I don't know the subject title, and I don't know who your guests are, but I agree with, I think, 100% of everything I've heard from them today, which gives me great heart, because this is my world they're talking about. I have worked, I'm 70 years old, and I have worked for money and pro bono for 501s, little bitty ones, great big ones. I was with the Pew Charitable Trust for 8 years. It doesn't come any bigger than that. But the world changed in 2008, as I think everyone now understands. All the dynamics are different. And there was a huge change in the 501 community, because a lot of the money just went away, and they had to get more creative. Well, I'm rattling on here. My point is, I worked for both the philanthropists and the recipients of their philanthropy.
And now you're feeling pretty heartened about seeing where we wound up in 2014.
Yes, absolutely. The electronic file of this should be sent to the head of every 501 in the world, and certainly in Hawaii.
Well, gee, well, thank you, Scott. But more than that, not to you know, go down a humorous path with it. But we have seen a real change in philanthropy, and a lot of people would suggest that this is a much more real way of approaching philanthropy and looking at how this happens with families.
I don't want to take too much more time, but I want to get in one other thought.
You got about
question.
30 seconds.
Okay. What I see all of it. I see money connecting with the issue that the money's being given for, and fabulous things happen. I more frequently see the money connecting with people that, for one reason or another, it becomes a business in their minds, and they forget about the mission. And then there's the ones that are entrenched in old ways of thinking that are never going to change. And I could go on and on and on about these various dynamics. But
okay, but I'm not going to let you do that, because I've got heads nodding around here.
Connecting the money with the philanthropy, more personal interest in the people who are giving the money.
All right,
and
Scott.
I'll leave it at that.
Thanks
you.
So much.
I want to have coffee with a whole bunch of you.
It's a date.
Aloha. And thanks, Scott, for the call. But the point being that there are so many ways in which philanthropy has changed. It's not just this movement or that movement. And then, although tonight we're talking about the influence and the impact of millennials and eugenics, but it's more than that. And looking at how that happens within the community and the changes happening, and Scott's saying, well, there's going to be a component of folks who are never going to change. And that's probably true. You're not going to get 100% buy-in of 100% of everything, you know, ever. But the movement as it's been happening now, say, over the last decade, certainly the times when, you know, you guys were coming of age and deciding that you were going to be involved with it. And I should say Melissa Jackson is on the board of the Zilber Family Foundation, and she's also part of the Hawaii chapter of Emerging Practitioners in Philanthropy. So is Ann Swain Kerr. She's also the co-chair of the Keith and Judy Swain Family Foundation. And those parts of your lives that you've seen this shift happening, really, is there a point in time you think where this is going to become the norm and we're not going to talk about this as a movement anymore?
I think that I think Mel and I, our situations allow us to take on leadership roles in philanthropy, which is not necessarily the case. So there are foundations, large foundations, small foundations, that have leadership, older leadership. And I think when there is the intergenerational dialogue going on and maybe reception to hearing what Gen Xers and millennials have to say about philanthropy, then that's when change starts to happen. So I think the encouragement of having those dialogues are really important. And I've been really fortunate to have a father and mother who are really open to my ideas, even though they might not have agreed. They were open to listening. And I believe Mel is probably the same way. And so it allows you to step up, and then it allows, I think, like, the EPIP Hawaii, the whole idea behind EPIP Hawaii was Mel and I were really trying to create this entity where we could meet other young trustees. What ended up happening is we have created this regular opportunity for people to gather, young and old. And that multi-generational piece is, I think, the piece that's going to really make impact. And I don't think either one of us were really thinking about that. It was more like you're kind of quietly working in philanthropy in your little silo, and you kind of want to know, well, who are these other trustees that are out there, and can we connect with them, and what are they doing? Do we share the same values? But then it was like, this is magical to have, like, amazing executive directors who you totally admire and have so much humility and are amazing mentors in the same room with newbies who are just, like, awestruck. And to have them sitting and having conversation just about, like, issues in Hawaii is right there. That is going to take off, and it's going to create something different. And so the EPIP Hawaii, it's really developed into something that is exciting, and it could lead to change, hopefully. And the more people we have in the room, the better.
It's allowed conversations,
yeah,
which I think is huge with different generations, so that things aren't lost. Because what's happening is if they don't share it with us, then it gets lost. So.
Yeah.
I think it's been such a good platform for conversations to happen. And that's how we do it within a foundation. When you are going to donate, having those conversations with the people that are receiving are huge.
Yeah.
And making sure people are in place to make things go the way they want it to. And really, that's about having the people that you're donating to. They have to have that in place, really. And mm-hmm. and as a funder, you listen to that and you make it happen so that they can do what they're set out to do. They know best what they need to do. Funders sometimes do have to get out of the way. You kind of let them do what they know what to do.
And that's like the 2164, that organization that's in New York. I mean, they were created. It was actually created by young people who were sitting on boards of family foundations. And they realized, like, wow, I have peers that could be on family foundation boards, could be actually having a say in where that money is going in the community, but they don't want to be because they don't really feel comfortable. They don't have a voice. And so they created this organization to really, it's like consulting for family foundation members of how do you get the younger generation to feel comfortable enough to speak up and say, hey, you know, I think I think we should start doing things a little differently. And these are some of my ideas. And be comfortable with that. And then and having the founders of the foundations sharing their insight and their knowledge and having just a really healthy exchange of ideas and recreating the philanthropy that was established.
We're sort of dancing around a couple of issues. One of them would be the issue of succession. And really, how do you take that institutional memory along with the values of the people who started the Family Foundation and move that through the generations and also move and make changes and adjustments that reflect what's really happening right now? And then the other thing that you were talking about, too, is the fact that, you know, finding out that there are other people like you dealing with that same kind of question, how do I do this in a family foundation, which is not necessarily that different, perhaps, from a family business? I mean, there are certain ways that, you know, people go into therapy as families to be able to deal with the idea that they're also doing business together. And whereas your business is philanthropy, it still sounds like you've had to do a lot of legwork to make your family foundation work on the personal level as well as the philanthropic.
It's tricky. You have family dynamics. You're working with your father and mother. And I just feel really, really fortunate because I have great parents. So it made it pretty easy. But there's still challenges. And I think that that is a very, very important thing to have, is that communication with the older generation and the younger generation. And I mean, that's why that 2164 is like, they do consulting, you know, because sometimes those family dynamics get in the way of actually doing good with that money. And yeah, I had something else to say, but I totally lost it. But
it'll come back.
I was going to say, this 2164 consulting firm is needed because can you imagine taking sometimes legacy trusts that had formulated their bylaws or their giving principles, you know, in the last century or two centuries ago, and then you've got kind of a modern day interpretation that needs to happen of that to that, and with modern day communities that look very different from what they may have looked like centuries ago. So how do you facilitate that? How do you find the happy medium that preserves the legacy of the trust but also understands and meets the needs of a modern day community or community? So I think this is great that this is a resource now.
Well, that's a really good question that we would be asking you too, if you're involved in family foundations, if you're a younger trustee, if you are deeply involved in an organization. Do you find yourself bucking up against those who are older and wiser and seem to know, or at least want you to know, that they know best? 941-3689 is our number, 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. Now, I know you've got great parents, and you've got great parents, and I've got great parents, and we've all got great parents, but when you really have to sit down and negotiate your way through some of this stuff, and you're also talking about treading on someone's personal feelings as well as their analysis or assessment or ways that they've been doing it. Mel, have you ever had some issues that were just really, really thorny?
You know, I have to say we've been really lucky. We have an amazing board members. And yes, they're family members, but then we have others that are not family members.
And does that make a difference?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Highly recommend it. It's an outside vision coming in. Granted, everyone on our board knew my grandfather. So by carrying out legacy, is they know they looked him in the eye and promised something. So I think that's they're being held accountable because it just they remember that. They remember the mission of what we're supposed to be doing.
Right. But does that intimidate you and some of the ones who couldn't necessarily make that same promise in the same way because you're just generationally removed from a time where you could have made that promise?
You know, I was old enough when he passed away. It was only 3 years ago. So I was made to be responsible for. He made that very clear.
You were deputized.
Yes. And I just look, again, as a room full of mentors, that if we have anything that comes up, that it's a round table to talk about what's going on. And if there is an issue, we deal with it and make the best.
And then when you walk out the door, can you leave it?
Yeah. Yeah, I can do that.
It doesn't show up at the dinner table or Sunday brunch?
No, I mean, I feel really lucky that I have one sibling. I think that probably helps, you know, just so it, we can discuss things, but it's we kind of have very similar views.
You are lucky.
Go ahead. So, yes, I get along with my parents, and it's been a great journey, but it has not been without challenges, for sure. And just a little background, my mom was the founder and executive director of the Orange County Community Foundation. So when this foundation was created, it was very clearly created in a particular way, and we have done a lot of restructuring to how we go about funding, and we've had challenges and butting heads, and but which is totally healthy. And we have kind of a joke that's developing in our board. Sorry, Dad. But that my dad has emeritus status. So he really likes, I'm, you know, emeritus. And it's like, okay. And he, but he was very, I think, smart to say, okay, I want you to take on a different role. I want you to be the president of the foundation. Are you ready for this? Are you ready for it? Is this what you want? And I was like, yeah, I love this stuff. And so now I have a leadership role, but I still have the founder in the room. And I think that's really, really important because he is a mentor to me. But he also is open to learning from me as well. And then we have family members and outside directors and an advisory committee and all these amazing people that I can work with. So I am not in a situation where somebody passes away. Hey, you're going to be running this foundation, which often happens. I have no idea what I'm doing. I don't know anything about philanthropy. And I think that happens a lot, and it's frightening. And so I think that's another reason why handing over leadership roles to the younger members of your board is really, really a smart move, mm-hmm. because you can ensure that not only are the legacy that you have started will continue and flourish, but you can see your child in action. And it hopefully is comforting, you know, but I think that is a, for my experience has been great because it's helped me develop professionally and also just work with my dad at a totally different level, which is different. So,
but you're also talking about entering into succession at a time when he's still quite active, has institutional memory that would be helpful to you, but also has to be able to have the restraint to say she's got to do it in her own way.
Yeah.
And that can be a little difficult, too, as you're trying to put your own stamp and your own way of being on a leadership position that he created.
Yeah. Yeah. But we've done it. So it can be done, and it's not always easy, and that's why there are organizations like 2164, and there are different kind of organizations that are really addressing this issue because, like I said, there's this huge transfer of wealth, there's this leadership change, and if these uncomfortable conversations do not take place, who knows what the future is going to entail? Because that
possibly foundation's not existing anymore.
I don't know. So I think it's important to have these conversations, even if it's uncomfortable.
Lisa, when you are out there in the greater mm-hmm. community, because you come in contact with so many, many organizations of all different types and stripes, but is this a really rarefied group of people who are able to operate in the same way that Anne and Mel do with their family foundations?
I think so. This is very new, definitely. So I think it's, as I said earlier, it's very refreshing and welcomed. And I wish that every nonprofit across the state had a funding partner that kind of espouses the same kinds of values and is willing to go through these kinds of transitions, you know, with kind of transparently and openly and with trust and respect of their nonprofit partners. So,
is there some sort of percentage that each of you sees or would suggest for a board running a nonprofit now where you really would like to see, okay, you've got people who've been involved for a very long time and you don't have that many people who are new to the organization. I mean, is there an out time that you think should be there and whether it's implicit or explicit that you feel is really important for the health of your organizations and that you would sort of prescribe as being a good thing for the health of other family foundations or even other nonprofits which aren't family foundations?
So you're talking about boards on nonprofits?
Well, the board on the nonprofit, whether it's on a family foundation or a trust, or any organization where you don't have just a lot of sort of, gray heads telling everybody else what they should be doing and not necessarily understanding what and how those values that are so important to you and your respective generations play out in their communities.
I think, like I said before, I think there just needs to be healthy dialogue between the two generations and an openness on both sides.
Right, but that's if you have two generations.
Oh,
I guess
what
I'm saying is when you have a board of directors, and most organizations do, and there will be sometimes people will serve, and maybe they'll go away for a little while but then come back. Do you find yourself talking to your peers and saying, you really have got to get on these boards and it's really important that a board have a certain complement, whatever that might be, of people who are under 40 or under 50?
I think boards are starting to recognize they have to do that. There's only so many seats, and sometimes, not saying you have to clean house completely, but if someone's been in the position for a long time, and it is important to bring in new people and younger people before even the older people leave, but to switch things up a little bit.
And what kind of frequency do you ever say to the organizations that you talk to, or Lisa, that you talk to, in terms of how do you keep that freshness, even when people love that organization dearly? Do you say to them,
put a limit on it.
Term limits are a best practice, and diversity of, seeking diversity of thought, of perspective, in whether it's gender, age, mission, what have you, is always good for a board. If you have really great board members and they face a term limit, you can always invite them back later, but they're not going to be sort of sitting on this board in perpetuity. So I think those are great best practices to strengthen a board. And I think boards should be open to their own board development. Boards as a body, as a collective, should be open to learning and growing together and becoming stronger together, and whatever that means. And I would highly recommend, Anne alluded to great dialogue between her and her father. Her father's a very special guy. I think he's very enlightened in that regard, in that he's very open-minded about this process. Not every board has that kind of, or not every, not all leadership on boards has that insight. So I think it's best, it's a best practice to think about succession planning, even when you're not remotely even going to have a success, an executive transition of any sort, whether it's between the chief staff or a board chair, et cetera. It's always good for boards to have that conversation, even though it doesn't feel like a very real threat. It's just good practice for boards to be resilient and strong and insightful.
And one final thing, because we're getting to the end of the hour. It's gone by very quickly in talking to all of you and seeing the wonderful things that you're able to do. And I wish in some cases we could have little cameras around here sometimes, because you guys are just little twinkles. And you're twinkling and arcing and sparking all over the studio. Anne and Mel, well, you too, Lisa. You're a twinkle too.
Even though I'm jaded and old, is that what you're trying to tell me?
I didn't say that. Didn't say that.
My eyes twinkle too, Beth.
I know. But the point being that there's so much work that happens in the nonprofit communities, and there's so much that we need to have happen that we certainly saw witness after, the recession came into its full-blown existence, and now things have gotten better. As things have become better and the purse strings are a little bit more fluid, people sometimes, forget a little bit that some of the change that we came through that was not too happy in the way it occurred still came out with a very good result. Very, very quickly, from all of you, I want to just thank you so much. I just caught time there, and I want to thank you all for all the good work that you have been doing, and we'll see how all of this sticks. We'll all come back together in a couple of years and see how you are all doing. Anne Swinecare, thank you for being here. Lisa Moriyama, and to you, Mel Jackson. And all the great things that you guys do.
Great conversation.
We're all really, really grateful and hope there would be a lot more of you out there to do it too. I'm going to see you tomorrow morning. We'll see what's happening for an Aloha Friday version of The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Have a good evening. Aloha.